Welcome in to It's Always Sunny in Chiefs Kingdom. I'm Austin. Find me on Twitter /X at Real Bird Lawyer, on Blue Sky at Bird Law Expert. Here with me as always, my co-host Taylor at Taylor _ Witt on Twitter /X, on Blue Sky at Taylor M. Witt. What's going on, buddy?
Hey, not much. We packed show, so we didn't do a little riff before that, but we still are fired up to be part of the Fansided Network and fired up to bring you guys another awesome show.
Yeah, we didn't do a little riff before the show, but you did play ads before the show. I mean, I say you as if you have control over it. So, you know, I mean, like, instead of listening to us talk about OJ, which is what I wanted to riff about, it is like 10:30 on a Thursday night, and you still have to edit the pod.
We're chopping this baby up.
You know, it is what it is. Just a little peek behind the curtain here. Great show for you guys. As always, we've got news. And by news, I mean, we are going to talk more about Rashee Rice, because that is what we do primarily on this podcast. Unfortunately, regrettably, we do have our next installment of the Next Great American Dynasty, and we are talking about Super Bowl Live, so that will be exciting and great. And then we are going to close this out. We are joined by a very special guest, friend of the show, KCSN's own Craig Stout, to talk about the KCSN draft guide that was just released. Let's get into it. Rashee Rice has been charged and has turned himself in to police. There's a little bit of a question whether or not these are going to be the final or formal charges. I will get to that. But currently, we have 8 criminal charges against Rashee Rice. It is possible that these will not be the final charges. In some jurisdictions, the police are allowed to just get warrants without prosecutor involvement, even though it's prosecutors that ultimately charge cases. No cop writes you a speeding ticket. The cop has charged you with a crime. But for serious matters, police need to have babysitters, adults in the room, that are going to decide what the ultimate criminal charges are. There was a rumor going around this evening that perhaps the charges that were reported the other day might not be the final charges, and the DA may ultimately submit different charges when the case gets to them. I would be surprised if that were the case, but only because you would think in a case of this magnitude, of this level of press attention and this level of public scrutiny, that the DA and the police would talk to each other and they would say, you're going to get an arrest warrant for Rashee Rice. Well, let's maybe let me take a look at that first. Just make sure that we're on the same page. You know, if you're going to put some criminal charges out there and that's going to go to the press, and there's going to be people like Mike Florio and Dov Kleiman and all these other goofball aggregator Twitter accounts running about it, generating clicks and public outrage, let's maybe talk about this before we put it out there. I would be surprised if that didn't happen, but it's not completely outside of the realm of possibility, because these charges are a little bit goofy. So let me get into these really quickly here. For those of you that are tuning in to the show for the first time and maybe confused or maybe even concerned about my level of knowledge about criminal cases, I can assure you it is nothing untoward. I can assure you that I am an attorney in real life. I had a guy on Twitter the other day. He was like a Dolphins fan. And he's like, you're not a real lawyer.
I remember.
And I was like, okay, I mean, I am, but like, what do I have to do to convince you? And, you know, ultimately we ended up going our separate ways after, you know, he spent about 10 or 15 tweets out of his day telling me how much he didn't care, but also that he was certain that I wasn't a lawyer. I can assure you that I am. And I was a prosecutor for about 10 years in Missouri and then in Colorado. So this is something that is near and dear to my heart. Let's talk about these charging decisions. We've got 6 counts of collision involving injury. That is a felony. It carries a range of 0 to 5 years in prison, 0 to 365 days in jail, up to 1 year in jail, up to a $5,000 fine. That is an or. So could be one of those things, could be any of those things, any combination thereof. There is no mandatory jail time or prison time, no mandatory confinement on these 6 charges. So these are kind of the lower level charges here. We've got 1 count of collision involving serious bodily injury. That is a 3rd-degree felony in the state of Texas. It is punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. Now, does that mean 2 to 10? I mean, that's not zero, right? So does that mean if he's convicted of this charge that he will go to prison for at least 2 years? Not necessarily. Mandatory minimums do not apply if someone is sentenced to a non-incarcerative sentence. So there are types of charges, like, for example, murder, if you're not getting the death penalty, which I'm sure they still have in Texas. It's neither here nor there. We have gotten rid of that in our evolved cosmopolitan state of Colorado, but I'm sure they still are electrocuting people down there or whatever it is that they do. Mandatory minimums only apply if you are sentenced to prison. So if I'm sentenced for a crime, unless the crime says mandatory life without parole or something like that, I could be sentenced to probation. I could be sentenced to, in some states, a community correction sentence, halfway house, some sort of combination like that. In Missouri, we could send people to prison for 120 days and then they would come out and they'd be on probation after that. So if you're sentenced to any of these non-incarcerated sentences, those minimums do not apply. So yes, if he were convicted of that and he were sentenced to prison, the sentence would have to be at least 2 years, but that doesn't mean that he would have to do mandatory time on that. Aggravated assault. This is the top charge based on what has been reported so far. It is a second degree felony. It is punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $10,000. Same point that I just made about the mandatory minimum. If he were to be charged, convicted, and sentenced of that crime, and he were to be sentenced to prison, he would have to do at least 2 years. He could face a maximum of 20. He would not have to be sentenced for prison. In the extremely unlikely event that this were to end with him being convicted of a second degree felony for aggravated assault, which I would describe as like there's no chance of it happening. There's a better chance of an asteroid hitting the Earth tomorrow and killing all of us than there is of Rashee Rice being convicted of aggravated assault, a second degree felony in the state of Texas. But were that to happen, there is still a chance that he could be sentenced to a non-prison sentence and he wouldn't have to spend any time in jail. So any questions so far?
Yeah, what do the charges actually mean?
That's a great question, Taylor. So the charges are simply a statement of what charges have been brought to this point in the case. And again, we don't know for a fact that these are going to be the final charges. These are just accusations, essentially, right? They're not evidence. They're not convictions. They're just accusations that the police and or the DA have made against Rashee Rice. To file charges in a criminal case, all you need is to find a judge who says, I agree that there is probable cause that these crimes were committed by this person. And that's all you need to get an arrest warrant. Probable cause in the criminal justice world is like a pretty low standard. It's actually like the lowest standard we have to prove anything, right? Like it goes up from probable cause, culminating with, of course, the standard of proof the prosecution has to meet in a criminal trial, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's like, we're not allowed to quantify these things for lay people, but probable cause is like 50.1%. It's like, it's like, yeah, probably happened. And for it to probably happen, it's like a little bit better than 50% likely that it happened. And it happened and it was committed by this person. That's all you need to charge somebody with a crime. To convict somebody, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the number that people usually attach to that is like 95 to like 90%. Uh-huh. You have to be like really quite sure that this person, committed the murder or whatever to convict them of a crime. So at this stage, we just have accusations, and they're not necessarily even an indication of what the final plea is going to be. Everybody knows that the criminal justice system has a lot of plea bargaining in it. There's a reason for that. It's not because, people are necessarily trying to screw people. All that certainly does happen. This is America after all. But a lot of the reasons why plea negotiations take place and why charges get pled down is it's just an efficiency issue, right? If you have a case that you've charged and you feel like the evidence is good, yeah, you could try every case like that, but then you would be in trial literally all the time. No prosecutor or defense attorney wants that. There's no need to try every single case. They know you're guilty. You know you're guilty. So why don't you just come to the table like adults and see what you can work out? So sure. That's kind of where we're at this stage of the case.
So are there going to be any additional charges at this point, or is this kind of the end of the charges?
I kind of doubt it. I mean, unless there is a miscommunication or a lack of communication between the police and the DA, and the DA, once this case gets into their system, like now that he's turned himself in tonight, the DA probably will be filing formal charges here in the next 24 to 72 hours. In Missouri, we had to do it within 24 hours, which was very stressful when I was, you know, an on-call prosecutor.
I remember.
In Colorado, it's 72 hours. So you've got like 3 days. You have like tons and tons of time to file formal charges in Colorado before somebody has to be released on bond. Now, Rasheed Rice has already been released. He posted a $40,000 bond. But I would expect the formal charging document to come out in the next day, 1 to 3 days. And once that comes out, I mean that to me is very likely to contain all the charges that we're going to see. This is not a super intensive investigation. They know he was driving. He admitted through his attorney that he was driving, mm-hmm. and his attorney probably only said that because he told the police that he was driving.
Right.
And he wouldn't have made that statement to police with a lawyer representing him unless he knew the police had evidence that he was driving. And we've seen some of that obviously leaked publicly. So, you know, other than injuries, and we'll get to that in a second, other than injuries, you know, I mean, sometimes traffic crash investigations, especially in a hit and run, can take a long time because you need somebody to come out. You know, you have specialized highway patrol investigators that are going to come out and like reconstruct the accident, literal accident reconstructionists. Not necessary in this case to charge it because you know who did it. You know who the drivers were. You know more or less what happened. You've even got the benefit of a civilian dash cam video that shows the accident happening, right? So, like, there's just not a whole lot of investigating to do. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not still potentially talking to witnesses, that they're not still potentially pulling video or talking to the victims or, you know, keeping in touch to see what injuries might develop, you know, if there's residual trauma physically. Not mentally, because that's not something that you charge crimes off of, although, you know, obviously it's relevant. Uh-huh. So I kind of doubt it. I kind of think that whatever charges we see here in the next day or two, the final charges, whenever we see them, and they may be identical to the ones that have already been reported, if the DA and the cops did talk beforehand, I kind of think that's going to be it. And then at some point, we will find out that there was a plea agreement. Those charges will be reduced to something else, and that'll be the end of it.
So what's the deal with the serious bodily injury assault charge, the biggest, the most serious one of these? Like, what do you know about that?
Oh, my God. I'm glad that you asked, because this actually is a little bit weird. So in Texas, you can assault somebody intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, which is true of most states. However, in Texas, and I gave this a very cursory search, so if I have any Texas attorneys listening to this, they're like, you bozo, you are Florio-ing this all over the place. Please don't do that to me, but gently correct me through a DM or, a discreet tweet on x.com. We have different levels of assault depending on your culpable mental state, right? Like if I recklessly hurt you, that is a less serious crime than if I intentionally hurt you, right? That's
right.
That's sort of how the general precepts of criminal justice work. In Texas, you can cause an assault intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. And if you cause serious bodily injury, regardless of how you cause it, it's the same level of felony, I believe, from the way that I read the statute, which is very bizarre. In this case, a car is a deadly weapon, and the injury, there was the end result was serious bodily injury. So does it matter that you intended to use your car as a deadly weapon and, you know, you just happened to crash into somebody and cause a serious bodily injury? Maybe not. Apparently not, from the way that I read Texas law, which is a little bit unusual. Most jurisdictions, certainly all the ones that I've ever practiced in, would consider, you know, a non-DUI traffic crash to be like reckless at worst conduct, right? Like, for me to intentionally hurt you, that'd be like I deliberately ran over you in my car. Like I saw you there and I just ran right over you and tried to kill you.
Sure, happens.
Texas is a little bit odd. So who knows exactly what the situation is. But you asked about serious bodily injury. So Texas defines serious bodily injury similarly to Colorado and Missouri. Bodily injury that creates a substantial risk of death or causes death, serious permanent disfigurement or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ. We don't know for sure what the serious bodily injury is in this case. I did X about this, but obviously the reporting was that there were no serious injuries. That's obviously a medical diagnosis and not a legal determination when it was being put out that no one was in serious condition.
Yeah, someone could have broken a finger, right?
That's exactly right. So actually, in Colorado, the only way our definition of serious bodily injury differs from the Texas definition is it adds to this definition that I just read off any breaks or fractures and any burns of whatever the most serious level of burn is. Second degree, third degree.
Yeah, a degree. I always forget
which one is the least and most serious. But in Texas, it's possible that they view like you said, a broken bone. In Colorado, we explicitly define that as serious bodily injury. But, you know, if I break a finger and I can't write or whatever or type because I've got a little splint on my finger, that's protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member, potentially. You know, whether a jury would necessarily view it that way or not, we don't know. The SBI in this case, it appears, I will note that this is speculation on my part, but we do have a statement from a lawyer representing one of the victims about her injury. And this is really the only information we've gotten about any of the injuries in this case, which is why I'm guessing this might be the serious bodily injury that the charges are referring to. She had a very big laceration on her left eye. She's got several stitches that were put in at the hospital, and the eye socket is completely swollen and black and blue.
Ooh.
Let's assume that that is what the serious bodily injury is. We look at this definition, and the only one that jumps out as a possible fit for serious bodily injury there is the serious permanent disfigurement. She got some stitches, right? A very big laceration on her left eye, several stitches that were put in at the hospital. It's possible that could cause some scarring, some facial scarring.
Sure.
And it certainly is possible, and we obviously haven't seen the photos. We don't even know if this is what the SBI that we're talking about, but that could be it, right? Like, you could be asking the jury to, you know, were this to go to trial, to say, look, this lady got 12 stitches on her face. She's going to have a scar for the rest of her life. That's serious permanent disfigurement.
Sure.
This is second degree assault and, you know, aggravated assault. Convict him of that. Find him guilty. We don't know, but there's a spectrum of serious bodily injuries, even under this definition. This is an objective definition of what serious bodily injury is. There's still a lot of subjectivity to serious permanent disfigurement, right? Like, we can try and define as many things as we want in the legal world, but at the end of the day, if, you know, a case goes to trial, it comes down to whether the prosecution can convince 12 jurors to unanimously agree that, you know, this injury is serious permanent disfigurement, or whether the defense can convince one juror that it isn't and have them hold out and either cause a mistrial or eventually, you know, 12 angry men, whatever, unanimous acquittal. So will any of this make a difference towards the plea deal? I think if this is the SBI, this is definitely on the much less serious end of the spectrum. You know, SBI could range from, you know, I
like broke, you said, death.
Yeah, right. I broke a finger or I died. Like, you shot me and I died. Now, in that case, you'd probably charge me with murder. But,
the tack the SBI on there for another year.
Yeah, and, you know, attempted murder. But, like, if I get shot, if you shoot me in the head and, you know, I don't die, but, like, I'm in a coma for a couple of weeks and then I wake up, like, that's serious bodily injury. That was a substantial risk of death, right?
Totally.
That is the same level of injury that we're talking about here with, like, a facial laceration that might cause some scarring, right?
Big wide range
in terms of the conduct, big wide range in how that would be perceived by a prosecutor in plea negotiations and how that might come out in the wash.
Okay, I have two more things for you. Number one, the worst type of burn is a fourth degree burn.
Okay, good. So, wow, fourth degree. Oh my God.
One is the least and that's four, like, is the worst.
Fourth degree is like Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru.
In
episode four. Like, yes, literally, there is definitely a some serious
bodily injury happening with fourth degree burns for sure. Number two, how surprised are you at the recent developments with the charges and with what's happened with Rashid?
I mean, I am a little bit surprised by the assault charge and the serious bodily injury aspect of it. And I want to know more about that because we don't have a lot of information at this point. When the police apply for an arrest warrant, they get what's called a probable cause statement in Missouri. In Colorado, we just call it the affidavit, but it's a probable cause affidavit. It's a sheet of paper where the police basically write down the facts that establish probable cause for you to be able to get an arrest warrant, right? And so we haven't seen that yet. I assume at some point that will be leaked to the public. Somebody will probably pull that and it'll be a public record. And so that will probably be leaked at some point. And it probably will tell us, number one, it will tell us who suffered the serious bodily injury, and it will tell us what the police think the serious bodily injury is. So that'll give us a lot more information. I'm also a little bit surprised that there's no leaving the scene or racing charges in here, because that really seemed like the obvious choice,
right?
To charge,
especially
him.
Leaving.
Yeah, instead you have a collision causing serious bodily injury, and then you have the aggravated assault in particular seems. I mean, it is a higher level of charge. So, you know, you could say, like, look, this is a higher level charge than racing and leaving the scene. So they wanted to shoot for the highest level of charge that they felt like they could reasonably prove. Can they prove it? I don't know. It's kind of an interesting charging decision, because there's sort of two broad schools of thought when you're a prosecutor, right? One is that you charge as high as you possibly can charge, and you negotiate down from there, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, this laceration, it might be serious permanent disfigurement. I can get a judge to agree that I have probable cause that there's an aggravated assault here. I'm going to charge it. Can I prove it at trial? I don't know. Probably not. But let's charge it. I have the leverage in the situation. I'll go to the defense attorney. I'll be like, look, I charged your guy with a class 2 felony here. Like, he's facing 20 years in prison. I'll give you whatever you want. But, like, just know that I can totally take this to trial. And your guy could get 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then the defense attorney is going to be like, yeah, probably not, though. So the camp that I would have fallen into as a prosecutor is I charged what I could prove. And I typically would not file a charge that I didn't feel pretty confident at the time that I charged it, that I could take the trial and win. And that's sort of, to me, a more honest way to view the prosecution of people, like people that are accused of crimes. Like,
the
maybe
job of a prosecutor,
just because we
yeah.
maybe just because we can charge people with crimes doesn't mean that we should, you know, unless we actually
okay,
can
Jurassic
prove,
Park.
Unless we can prove that they actually did it. But not everybody feels that way. And it's really hard to say, number one, I mean, even if you could make broad generalizations about how the Dallas District Attorney's Office operates, and we've done that on this show, you know, it's an urban environment. Those tend to be, you know, soft on crime, you know,
right.
Especially in Texas, and especially compared to more rural jurisdictions in Texas. But even if you can make sort of those broad generalizations about the Dallas DA generally, we don't even know who the DA, the individual DA of the hundreds and hundreds of DAs in that office is making the charging decision, and who's going to be negotiating the plea. And we just, there's a lot of, you know, with a case like this, because it's made press, it almost certainly will at least have some oversight from a fairly senior attorney in the office, perhaps even the district attorney, him or herself. But it's really hard to predict, you know, without knowing these people personally, or even who is handling the case at this point, what their motivations are for charging the charges that they do. So all that to say that there's still a lot more for us to find out. I don't think the situation has radically changed, even though I do think that the charging decision here is interesting. And it is certainly for the lawyers among us, it's been very interesting to speculate about. For those of you who have reached out to me on X and have discussed with me the, you know, the possible motivations for how this has been charged, shout out to our guy Seth Kaiser, of course, friend of the show. It's been really fun and interesting to sort of speculate about why things are being done the way they're being done, but we really just don't know. So stay tuned. Let's turn to some real news. There's real actual news on this podcast.
Woo.
Besides Rashee Rice, the Chiefs totally signed a couple of guys. One was offensive lineman Mike Caliendo, who I always think of Frank, of course.
How could you not?
When I see that name. But safety, Nazi Johnson. And I stress the word safety because that is a little bit interesting.
Yeah.
Wasn't he getting first team reps at cornerback last training camp before he got
definitely
hurt?
He was.
He was drafted as a safety, of course, in the 7th round out of Marshall a couple of years ago. It was interesting to me that he was listed as safety. He's returning. He was on a reserve contract. They already tendered him a deal a couple of weeks ago. That's been accepted. He is officially returning. But I wonder if this is a case of a social media intern get too big for his britches, or you know, whatever, you know, reading off the teleprompter Ron Burgundy style, or if this is actually an indication of where the team sees his role. I'm guessing it's probably more of the latter, just sort of social media chicanery, and you know, that is the position that he was drafted as sometimes.
Oh, more of the former. Okay.
Yeah, default back to, yeah, what did I say?
You said latter. It's fine. I just was trying to follow you.
You're right. I confused this too. That's me. That's on me. But it is a little bit interesting that that we have Nazi Johnson listed as safety in this return message.
Yeah, I'm excited about Nazi. I think that he was a guy that you know, has certainly had some positive momentum before his injury last year. And I think he's a guy that the Chiefs were really positive about too. Caliendo's good depth. Obviously both of these guys are, if anyone was unaware, former Chiefs. This is, I mean, you know, re-signings, and certainly think they're good fits if the team decided to bring them back before the draft and all that. So yeah, they're filling out the roster slowly but surely. Hey, Kansas, if you haven't downloaded the BetMGM app yet, you will definitely want to take advantage of this offer. New users who sign up through our link can get up to $1,500 in bonus bets paid back if their first bet does not win. This means if you place a $50 first bet and the bet loses, you will be credited with a $50 bonus bet to use on your next wager, up to $1,500. This offer is only available if you sign up through our link at bit.ly/sunnymgm. You can find the link in the episode description to start signing up. Again, the link is bit.ly/sunnymgm. This offer is only available to new customers who are 21 or older and physically present in Kansas. Please gamble responsibly. If you or a loved one has a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700. Check the episode description to see if you qualify.
Let's pick up the latest installment of the next great American dynasty, where we are recapping and diving into every playoff game of the Patrick Mahomes era. And we've got a very special one tonight. Chiefs 31, San Francisco 49ers 20, and Super Bowl 54. And of course, we talked about this game on the podcast before. We started the podcast a couple of weeks after this victory, and it was all we talked about for weeks and weeks, along with John Elway and how overrated he is.
Of course.
But we didn't have the Chiefs system. We didn't have the benefit of our tried and true system that we now have to guide our discussion of these games. And so that's what we're going to do.
That's what we're going to do. We have, of course, the Chiefs systems, the Chiefs acronym that the Chiefs follow when they win games, and it's create drama, handle adversity, inspire hope, engage physically, finish strong, and separate entirely. So as you said, this system certainly guided this game. Some of them it fits snug, some of them it fits a little loosely. This one it fits pretty comfortably. We start off with create drama. The stage was obviously set. It was Super Bowl 54, the first appearance by the Chiefs in the big game in 50 years. They of course were just coming off of back-to-back double-digit comebacks in the playoffs, the two previous games. The Niners, on the other side, they went 5-0 in Super Bowls between 1981 and 1994, but then had only been back to the big game one time since 94. It was in 2012 in the Harbaugh Bowl, or the Blackout Bowl, whatever you want to call it, when the Niners lost to Baltimore. So the Niners still come in five rings, big bad Niners, 5-1 in the Super Bowl. Spoiler alert, they are no longer 5-1 in the Super Bowl. They were 13-3 in 2019. They had the third best point differential in football, and their passing offense with Jimmy Garoppolo it ranked anywhere between 7th and 13th in most offensive statistical measures. That Shanahan offense still, of course, can cook even when your quarterback is Jimmy G. But their rushing offense is clearly where they shined. They were consistently in the top two with the Baltimore Ravens, and a huge reason why they were 4th in total offense and 5th in total yards per play was their dynamic rushing game. Their defense also was nasty. They were 5th in sacks, 2nd in total yards, 3rd in opponent first downs, 8th in points allowed. They had the quadruo. I was going to say trio, but they're four. Quad squad.
Quadrilogy.
The quad squad of Eric Armstead, Dre Greenlaw, Fred Warner, and Nick Bosa. They were all making their first of two career Super Bowl starts against the Chiefs in this game. So that was the stage for the create drama. Now, emotionally for me, I remember being pretty easy to manage my emotions given the massive circumstances. The Chiefs were playing in their first Super Bowl of my life. I was determined to enjoy it. I know during the game I like everyone, got stressed and stuff. But I do remember the lead up. I was pretty chill. Typically, create drama involves some game time drama. There was obviously plenty of that in this one, but we'll kind of start the system off with the lead up to the game. In this case, the Chiefs were 1.5 point favorites. We saw a ton of talking heads going with San Francisco picking before the game started. What do you remember about the pregame drama, the drama of being in your first Super Bowl, all that lead up stuff?
What I remember, I don't know if I remember it most, but I'm going to shout out our Kansas City Royals, who are, kicking
They're
ass
cooking.
again.
Yeah,
They're
9-4. Break them up.
good at baseball again, and just swept the Astros and fuck Houston and fuck those cheaters, et
Yep.
cetera, and so on and so forth. But I will land this plane, because what I remember feeling about this is, it was very similar to, in terms of the way it was sort of being portrayed in the media, it felt very similar to me to the 2015 World Series against the Mets, where everyone
Oh,
was
this is
taking the
good.
Mets,
Mets in
and
six.
Mets in six, hashtag Mets in six. And it was very much like, I remember reading these articles like it was literally yesterday, and it was
Yeah.
all it
Yeah,
was
me
it, there
too.
was literally a blurb on one of these articles on ESPN or MLB.com or whatever, where it was, a paragraph blurb from each of the writers, and one of the writers was like, look, the Royals have the better bullpen, and the better lineup and better defense, they're better at base running, et cetera, so on and so forth, but the Mets starting pitching is better, so Mets in six, right? And it felt like the dialogue around this game was very much on, Mahomes and, the best player versus the better team.
Yeah.
And the
He's gotten that
difference,
comp a couple times in his
yeah,
run.
and against San Francisco 49ers a couple of times. So we'll
Right.
have this exact same conversation again in a couple of
I'll
months as
just clip this
we're,
and replay
yeah,
it in a
right.
couple
We'll
weeks.
just replay the entire thing again. We'll recycle our trash, as it were.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was a really similar conversation, except of course the Chiefs were on the Mets side of things, and most people were taking the Niners in this game. Even though the Chiefs were 1.5 point favorites, it felt like most of the talking heads were on the side of, well, yeah, sure. I mean, Patrick Mahomes is great, and obviously the Chiefs have a big advantage at quarterback, which is by far the most important position. But like, look everywhere else on the roster. Tight end, it was Kelce versus Kittle, right? Like,
Yeah.
sure, Kelce is one of the greatest of all time, but like, this guy, George Kittle, he's been a monster. Like, he's one of the
And
best
he's
tight ends in the league.
funny when we talk to
Right.
him, so
Yeah,
everybody
sure.
loves him.
He's got a WWE personality, et
He does. I
cetera.
love George Kittle, but
He
you're
is great.
absolutely right in the comp.
But
And then also Andy Reid, who hadn't won a big
well, yeah,
game.
and he had one. And so the disparity between him and Kyle Shanahan, I mean, there wasn't one, right? Like,
No.
you had
They were
Kyle
both guys
Shanahan,
that
who
blew Super
obviously had
Bowls.
had choked 2023 as the offensive coordinator of the Falcons. And then you had Andy, who had lost his only Super Bowl appearance previously with the Eagles, and
Yep.
was criticized for how he managed that game down the stretch, as Kyle Shanahan was. So it was a really interesting lead up to it. But I agree, like, in terms of the anxiety, I don't think that really set in for me until 30 minutes before
Yeah.
kickoff. And you're
Yep.
like, oh my
Same.
God,
Oh my
like,
God, it's coming. It's here.
we're gonna win or lose the Super Bowl tonight.
Yeah, within a
And it's
matter of
gonna
hours.
completely change our lives for
And it
the
did.
better or for the very worse.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, of course, the drama's created. Now we hit handle adversity. The team, I felt, handled the moment of the Super Bowl pretty well from the opening kickoff of the game. It didn't feel to me like the game was too big for them. San Francisco started the game off with a field goal to open the scoring, but the Chiefs then they converted one third down on the next drive with a Damien Williams run, and then were faced with third and 11 at the Niners' 15-yard line. Mahomes scrambles for 10 before getting absolutely popped out of bounds by Jimmy Ward. Of course, everyone remembers that's a good ass hit, though. Oh, 2-0, that's a good ass hit. I mean, Pat was fired up. He went on the sideline and was like, yeah, I never even felt that. The sack hurt harder than that. Setting up, though, when Pat got hit and the ball popped out, a fourth and one play. And this sets up one of the many iconic moments from this game. Shift the Rose Bowl right parade. And Frank on the sideline in the mic'd up. They've been working all week down there. I wonder what Andy's going to pull out. I mean, Frank was obviously he knew that the Chiefs were cooking. And then that, of course, Rose Bowl was a Damien Williams rush down to the one, and Mahomes punched it in with a rushing touchdown. Nice little option that he kept and swooped around the right side for a 7-3 Chiefs lead. And then to keep the adversity being handled, Jimmy G threw a pick on their very next drive to Bashaud Breeland, which would lead to a Butker field goal and a 10-3 Chiefs advantage. Now, the Niners would tie up the game before halftime, but they also got a call, an OPI called on Kittle that negated what might have been, what might have set up a field goal before half. It was like a 40-yard pass that was clear OPI. Niners fans, of course, one of the many things they bitched about in this game. But anyway, that kind of set the stage for both teams to go into the locker room tied at 10. How did you feel the Chiefs handled the adversity of the big moment in the first half and playing against these Niners?
Yeah, it was an interesting game because obviously, and this sort of is a theme in the three Super Bowl wins, and to be clear, also the one Super Bowl loss.
Yes.
I mean, it felt like the Chiefs were being really dominated physically in the first half of the game, and really on the first couple of drives, we saw young Deebo Samuel in this game with a preview of the menace that he was going to become for the rest of the league, you know, ripping off these end arounds and getting these carries out of the backfield and just running guys over.
Yeah, he was nice.
You know, this defense had played a really physical game against Tennessee. They had a week off. You know, you get the bye week with the Super Bowl, but this was a weird defense because you had obviously Frank Clark and Tyrann Mathieu coming in to give the defense some attitude, which had been lacking sorely in the 2018 Chiefs defense, and you know, turn that around, which they did. But this was still, in a lot of ways, a finesse-y kind of defense, right?
Vestiges of Bob Sutton still there, yeah.
There were, and yeah. It showed up from time to time. And even with Tyrann, who obviously was, you know, one of the emotional leaders of the team, you know, there were some moments where this team was a little bit afraid of contact. And, you know, I mean, like, compare it just to last year's Chiefs defense, the level of physicality isn't remotely close. I mean, nope. It just is.
Agreed.
The ability to physically dominate an opposing offense and the same offense, which, you know, we'll talk about it when we get there, is a stark difference. And that's what sort of stuck out to me when I was rewatching this first half, is how really, I mean, same deal with the Chiefs offense, you know, up front, the offensive line, you know, and this was the, you know, the great tackle bookends, you know, Eric Fisher, and then, of course, Mitch Morse, or not Mitch Morse,
Schwartz.
But yep. Mitchell Schwartz, at yep. Right tackle, the GOAT, you know, obviously holding their own, but like this was a nasty, nasty defensive front from the Niners, yes. And they were getting home. I mean, they were getting pressure, and when I say getting home, I mean, you know, Mahomes took, what, like one sack in this game or whatever it was.
Oh, he took four, actually, but there were four. A lot of escapes. That's crazy. Also.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually surprised by that because I hadn't looked back at the box score that he actually – I mean, it's crazy. Like, it is crazy, though.
A lot of them were in the first half, actually.
They were. And the thing is, too, like, it's been – one of the things that's been so interesting about this exercise is to go back and look at Patrick Mahomes' evolution. I mean, that's part of the reason we wanted to do this, you know, retrospective, is to go back and sort of explore his career through the lens of his – playoff performances. And of course, like, he was still really good at not taking sacks, you know, in his rookie year, he was at 5.4, which actually was the highest sack percentage of his career in the regular season, 4.3% sack percentage in the regular season in 2018, and then 3.4 in 2019. So he cut it way down. But I mean, this wasn't the Mahomes, the final form that we saw in terms of being able to avoid pressure and make plays. And they were getting to him a little bit.
They were. And to put a bow on the sacks, it was a 1 yard sack in the first quarter. So, he's running around. He's trying to make a play. They get him down behind the line. Then there was a Bosa sack for 7 yards. He actually forced a fumble in the third quarter, but the Chiefs recovered it. And then in the fourth quarter, DeForest Buckner got him for 9 yards. And then there was another scramble in the fourth quarter where he lost a yard on a scramble running around looking. And they ended up scoring on the next play, but that was a sack too. So, you know, 2 1-yard sacks are certainly not.
Yeah, sure. Technical sacks.
Yes, they are. They are tackles behind the line of scrimmage of the quarterback, but it's not like he was back there getting battered and bruised. So that was a handle adversity, and now we get to inspire some hope. So we're going to fast forward a little bit in the game through the next 4 drives, which set the stage for this hope inspiration. The San Francisco 49ers kicked a field goal to start the second half. Then Mahomes immediately threw a pick. little behind Tyreek, kind of a miscommunication between those two. San Francisco scored a touchdown, and then the worst part. Pat throws the second pick, San Francisco. The worst part for them was they celebrated their apparent Super Bowl victory in the end zone with 12 minutes to go in the game and a 20-10 lead and the football. They thought there's no chance on this defense with the ball and 12 minutes to go and a 10-point lead. They thought this game was over, and they all go and do their big group shot. But fortunately for us, there's more football to be played. Hope was rekindled after the Chiefs forced a punt with 9 minutes to go, and the Chiefs moved from their 17, where they got the ball from the punt, to the 35-yard line before a second and 15 pass to Tyreek, which would have been a first down, was correctly overturned on replay, setting up third and 15. Basically, when the Chiefs system was formed, Inspire Hope was born from this next play. This is what Inspire Hope is. 2-3, Jet Chip Wasp, now one of the most all-time iconic plays in sports history, but started off as just a team with their backs against the wall, needing to land a counterpunch to stay in this thing, to keep fighting. And it was quite the counterpunch, I will say. The Chiefs did indeed have time to run Wasp, as Patrick asked offensive coordinator Eric Bieniemy before the play. All season, the Niners defense had only allowed 8 completions through the regular season and the playoffs of over 20 yards in the air. Their zone defense was incredible. That was the fewest in the NFL in the last 14 seasons, so since 2005. But their zone defense on this one paid a little too much attention to Sammy Watkins underneath. He drew the attention of 3 zone defenders, and Tyreek streaked wide open in the left deep third of the defense. This was a play that, I mean, everyone's, I'm sure, seen all the turning points and all the stuff about this, but this was something that the Chiefs kept in their back pocket for a moment like this. They knew this would work. They scouted it really well. Mahomes drifted back. When he said time to run Wasp, that's time in the pocket. That's not time in the game. That's, can we let this play develop in order for me to go deep? So he drifted back 14 yards, threw a pass 57 yards in the air, which was the longest completion by air yards in the 2019 season for the Chiefs. And he gets smacked by DeForest Buckner as he releases it, but he puts it in where Tyreek is running basically untouched in the deep third. He settles under it. The Chiefs have new life. Quite the inspirational play if there ever was one.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, this is what the eye for Inspire Hope was invented for. And it's crazy, like, to think back to when we first saw the first Turning Point video of the many that we would go on to enjoy over the years to come.
Yeah, we'll talk about a couple more later. Yeah,
this was the OG, and I think the most iconic of all of the Turning Point videos, because look at the material that you have to work with. I mean, the NFL films shots of him asking, you know, do we have time to run Wasp on the sideline? You know, the dramatic narrator saying, you know, like, you know, whatever he says about Mahomes, like making this call in this moment in his first Super Bowl, all this stuff. I mean, it is crazy. Like, just the level of drama that we aspire to. I will say, like, every time we bring up this game, I am sort of ethically obligated to mention that after the second pick, I thought we were coached, and I thought the game was over.
Dude,
and
I
tweeted as much. I was like, that's what it feels like to lose the Super Bowl. And to be fair to me, technically correct,
That is what it felt like. Absolutely. That is what
it felt like to lose the Super Bowl.
Absolutely.
Because I was convinced personally in my mind that that is what was going to happen in the game. So that is what I felt like, and that is what it does. Having seen the Chiefs lose the Super Bowl,
I can tell you
what it does feel like. And I experienced that in both of the other two Super Bowl victories as well. So, you know, we've been there. But at the time, we just didn't have that perspective. And that's been one of the consistent themes, and will be one of the consistent themes with this project going forward, is we just didn't know what we were in for, right? Nope. Like, down 10 in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl, when your second year as a starter quarterback has just thrown his second interception and the team just can't move the ball, and you've just given the ball back to a team that theoretically can run down your throat, has run down your throat for a lot of the game, and, you know, is one of the most potent offensive play designs, offensive schemes in the history of the NFL.
Maybe the most. Yeah.
Yeah. And then to have it all turn around in the course of, you know, 12 minutes. Yeah, 9 minutes. Exactly. Incredible stuff. Literally, like, the most inspirational thing that's ever happened.
Agreed completely. So then we get to E, engage physically. And from the moment that Tyree caught that ball, it was a brand new game. And not only brand new, it was basically the exact opposite game.
The game was basically over.
It was. The Chiefs misfired on a couple passes after that. But then on third and 10, threw the ball to Kelce that was a clear DPI in the end zone, got the ball at the 1 yard line. Mahomes found Kelce one play later, cut the San Fran lead to 3 points with 6 minutes to go. You know, all well and good, but this section of the Chiefs system is about engaging physically. And so this is about how the defense responded to this new opportunity. There was a 5 yard run on first down by the Niners, but then Chris Jones comes screaming into the backfield, knocks down a pass intended for Kittle that would have gone for a pretty huge gain. It was a really nice breakup by Chris Jones, setting up third and five. The Chiefs again got great pressure on the play, including Ben Neiman, Chiefs legend, screaming down the middle and hitting Garoppolo as his pass went nowhere near whoever he was throwing for there, giving the Chiefs their first three and out stop of the game at the most crucial time. I mean, this was after they just scored to cut the double digit lead. They had to get a stop, couldn't let the Niners do exactly what you just said and run the ball down their throats. And they didn't. They got a quick three and out. They got pressure. They did what they had to do. They engaged physically. When the Chiefs got the ball back on offense, they threw around to Tyreek and Travis for a couple plays. And on second and seven from about midfield, San Francisco 48, Sammy Watkins made the second biggest play of his Chiefs career. We, of course, covered his biggest play last week. Just putting Richard Sherman in an absolute blender on the outside for a 38-yard gain. Sammy juked outside, then he stabbed inside, then he kind of worked back around Sherman, who was turned around and got great leverage on him, and Pat put the ball, of course, exactly where it needed to go, got himself wide open. Massive gain, setting up the Chiefs for a 5 yard Damian Williams touchdown and their 4 point lead. This was just such an impressive, first of all, an impressive defensive stop, followed by such a explosive and physical route by Sammy at the absolute perfect time. He completely dusted a Hall of Fame cornerback at a time that the Chiefs needed a big play. They were engaged physically on defense. They were engaged physically on offense. They had new life. This was a team possessed.
Yeah. I mean, lots to cover there, obviously. Lots to go over. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy because we basically got through, you know, we got through three quarters of the game in the first two letters. And then
here
we are at the end. But you know what? The Chiefs system, it always succeeds, even when we have to force it a little bit. This was, I don't know. I mean, so much happened. Like it's so funny that you threw the Ben Neiman play in here because I had completely forgotten about it. Like, there are so many parts of this game that are etched on in my brain that I'll never forget. But then you forget sometimes that Ben Neiman was making a big play on third and five in Super Bowl Live to help set up the game. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't a sack, and you know, it was Ben Neiman making the play. So it's, I mean, like,
dude, what is a Chiefs Super Bowl win without randoms making big plays?
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
how but they, like, do it.
It's so funny that this was only now 5 years ago. And I like, as soon as you said it, and as soon as I saw it when I rewatched the game, I was like, oh, yeah.
Ben Neiman.
Yeah, good for him. Like, Ben Neiman out there making a play in a big spot.
He was a whipping boy.
But I just, like, you just don't. I don't know. It's crazy what you remember, what you don't. But yeah, of course, Sammy putting Richard Sherman in a blender was the subject of its own fairly iconic turning point video. And, you know, credit to Sammy for having the wherewithal to beat a Hall of Fame cornerback. Yeah, granted, on the downhill slope of his career, but
still pretty good this year with San Francisco.
Still a very formidable presence and was really good in this game. You know, having put in the time to tape study to say, look, I can beat this guy inside, go inside out on him and get open. And he did. I mean, it just was, it was a crazy, the end of this game, I don't know. I mean, like, of course I knew how crazy the end of this game was, but it was fun to go back and rewatch it because I've been hitting, this is my first time rewatching Live in a while. Because I've been
3 weeks.
obviously, well, I mean,
I'm kidding.
I've been hitting 57 and 58
Yeah.
pretty hard.
Yeah, we got a
And
lot to
we
go
got a
over
lot
and
to
ask about.
consume. And it was great to experience a classic.
Yes, it was. So now you get to the F, finish strong. The Niners do get the ball back, down 4, 2:44 to go. It's 24-20 Chiefs. The Chiefs defense, they needed a stop to finish this game strong. And the Niners came out and had their own ideas. They immediately started with a 17-yard Mostert run against a defense that looked kind of like they were playing soft, expecting a pass there. And the Niners did what they normally did and ran the ball well. But then George Kittle and Kendrick Bourne both followed with catches of 8 and 16 yards. So chunk, chunk, chunk right away, setting up first and 10 at midfield with the Super Bowl on the line and 1:49 left on the clock. So, now it's gut check time. You got to keep them out of the end zone. At least the Chiefs had a 4-point lead here, so they weren't protecting the 3-point. I'm sure the Niners would have just run a couple times and kicked a field goal if they could have, but they had to press. And so Chris Jones dials it up, finishes as strong as the future Hall of Famer has ever finished a game strong, knocking down one pass and getting a couple fingers on a second one that made that one flutter incomplete. Niners found themselves in 3rd and 10. They decided, all right, we can't keep throwing short because Chris Jones is just going to get everything. So we got to go over the top. They got Emmanuel Sanders open in the end zone over the top, but karma was not kind to Emmanuel Sanders after, of course, we all remember he snubbed the Chiefs in free agency several years before. And also Jimmy just flat out missed him. He overthrew him. Sanders had the route and he didn't get the throw. And so that brings up, of course, 4th down. And 4th down late in a playoff game in 2019 belonged to the same man that had owned each of the two previous Chiefs playoff wins, as Frank Clark once again came up with a sack, turned the ball back over the Chiefs. Frank the Shark, or Frank the Clark Shark, Mitch famously called him there, which was hilarious. Chiefs had a 4-point lead at the San Francisco 42 with 1:25 on the clock. The finish was coming in very strong here. That was as good of a defensive stand as you could ask for, given the circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you made Mitch's mistake the other way and said the correct thing
Yes,
when you were trying to say the wrong thing.
correct.
It
Yeah.
is actually, it's pretty hard to do. I've done it a couple of times when you try and repeat the iconic line. Yeah, I mean, karma's a guy on the Chiefs. He
Yes,
certainly is not
yes.
Manny Sanders.
No.
It was true 5 years ago. It's just as true, even more true now. I will say, obviously, we have to point out that, yes, Manny Sanders was open, and that play probably would have gone for a touchdown. I mean, if Jimmy hits the throw, it's probably a touchdown, and the
I
Chiefs are
mean, he's
down
open in
three.
the end zone, so
Yeah,
he's got to catch
exactly. I
it. And if
mean,
he
like
catches it, it is. Yeah.
we just it's but it's there's still time on the clock, and there's still Patrick Mahomes
Totally.
with time and with
And
timeouts
only a 3-point
to
deficit and a minute 25. Like, that game is over either way.
Harrison Butker to at
Yes.
least tie the game, and
Yes.
you don't think the Chiefs are scoring a touchdown in a
Right.
minute and 30 seconds?
Right. So now we get to S. Sometimes in my head, when I'm doing the Chiefs system and I get to separate entirely, I actually imagine the next play in my mind. Separate entirely is Damian Williams streaking down the left side of the field in Hard Rock Stadium, and my mind telling myself that my favorite team is going to win the Super Bowl for the first time in my life. That is separate entirely. That's what it is. And here's that moment, hand off Damian Williams trying to get to the edge, breaks a tackle, 35-30, Damian Williams 20, stays in bounds, 15-10, 5. Touchdown, Kansas City. Damian Williams runs to immortality and will be remembered forever in the Chiefs kingdom. That clip of Mitch has played in my mind more times than any other play-by-play of any other moment in Chiefs history. And sure, it's maybe not the most, involved play, or it's not the, but this moment just means the world to me. It was such a relief and the most joyous moment watching a sports team, I think, in my whole life was watching Damian Williams run and knowing that the Chiefs were about to win the freaking Super Bowl. It's as good of a separate entirely as there's ever been.
Yeah, and it was a, I mean, obviously they just needed the first down. The touchdown was just gravy on the cake, as it were.
Gravy on the cake.
You really have a I mean, all you need to do is get to the edge, get to the first down. They ran behind the sausage. You know, they threw the fullback run out there, which was just a little extra twist to the knife. You know that the Chiefs are going to run the ball, and you have to be able to stop it in that situation. Your lives are on the line, and they couldn't do it. And Damian goes into the end zone. And, you know, I get that technically the play there is probably to go down. Just like Jarek did against the Eagles.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad he scored the touchdown there.
Me too.
Like, I just like, the difference in the odds is so minuscule. Like, I get that it is statistically, but it's the difference between like 100% and 99.999%.
Well,
and it looks more lopsided on the scoreboard, and it's a cool ass highlight.
Yes.
Not that Jarek going down isn't also a cool highlight for its own reasons.
Well, but if I may, too, this play by Damian turned a 4-point lead into an 11-point lead with a minute to go, which is, you know, they need a score, onside kick score, just to beat you. The Jarek play, the game was tied.
Yeah,
and if he scores a touchdown there, Philly literally has a chance to go beat you on their possession.
That's true.
So, like, the win probability of Jarek going down versus Damian going down is much different. And, you know, get that game two scores. Like, even if you go down there, you could fumble the snap or something. And I mean, you know, like get it to the point where you need an onside kick involved. So I loved the decision by Damian to finish that runoff, just like I loved the decision by Jarek to go down. I thought they were both the right play.
Yeah. Incredible game, incredible memory. Let's do the awards. And I'll let you start off with our five-star man.
Five-star man. Of course, man that screams I'm a five-star man on the field.
Thank you.
You know, we're going to do the definitions on the fly here. That's okay. That's how it goes. That is teamwork. We are going to pick Damian Williams. I'm going to pick Damian Williams. 21 touches, 133 yards, 2 touchdowns, and most importantly, the happiest moment of my life. I mean, you know, that run right there was worth every single award that we could possibly give. So 5-star Damian.
I love that you gave him the 5-star man, and I love that we're talking about Damian Williams scoring a touchdown to ice the Super Bowl. This was like going back and watching this game and then just kind of reminiscing on this season. You know, the touchdowns against the Vikings, you know, where Tyreek, you know, caught him from behind and everything like that.
Yes.
It was a fun season. It was a great season for Damian. And, you know, one of those players that a tier above Ben Neiman in the pantheon.
A million tiers above
playoff Ben Neiman. Stars for sure. But, like, that's not a guy that's going into the Hall of Fame or even in the Chiefs ring. Well, I guess
he's got a shot at the Chiefs ring. He certainly doesn't.
I guess it's possible that he could have a shot at the Chiefs ring of honor. But that's my point, is this was a man for a time and a place in Chiefs history. And boy, was he ever up to the challenge. My 5-star man is Andy Reid. There obviously are a lot of different ways I could go with this. Andy went for it twice on fourth down before the last play of the game. Remember, the last play of the game was, you know, take the snap, drop back as far as you can, and then just chuck it and let time expire. So that doesn't really count. That was on fourth down.
Screwed up some betters, though.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Or the three previous ones where Pat ran back and kneeled. The three kneel downs combined to drop him below his over-under on rushing yards screwed a bunch of people over. But that's how it goes.
Andy doesn't care about that. Andy cares about winning his first Super Bowl. 2 out of 2 on the fourth down conversions before that final play, which includes Rose Bowl, obviously. He did pass up a 4th and 7 from the 13 after the other fourth down conversion. But, I mean, you know, it was the first half, second quarter. It's long down and distance. So it's fine. I mean, the decision-making here was good. I thought he was appropriately aggressive. And then, obviously, you know, the play calling in this game, were there some times when the offense – stuttered a little bit, sure, but I mean, you give Andy a couple weeks to fine-tune his single game plan, and he did not disappoint in this one. I understand that Rose Bowl, you know, Eric Bieniemy had a hand in coming up with that, and Wasp was a play that they had run before. They ran it against the Patriots in the AFC Championship game the year before, but this game plan was vintage, top-notch Andy Reid, and I think the part that really elevated him to my 5-star man status for this game is, you know, I mean, Pat was, I don't want to say he was shook. He definitely wasn't shook. Patrick Mahomes does not get shook. Patrick Mahomes does not get rattled. No. Okay. But if he did get rattled, after the second interception, that's when he would have been rattled, right? Like, if it were possible for him to feel fear, if it were possible for him to feel discouragement, that would have been when it happened. And he didn't, because it's impossible for him to feel those things. But also because Andy Reid was the perfect coach for that player in that moment. I just think the advice that he gave him, you know, obviously the clips coming out where he's like, I just told him to keep firing and, you know, you're good. We just need you to keep throwing, keep making the throws, keep being aggressive, you know, like quarterbacks. I mean, this was a second year starter, right? Like, he was the third or fourth youngest Super Bowl starter ever, I think, if memory serves.
Yeah.
He was the first or I think second youngest quarterback to win a Super Bowl.
Correct.
As a starter. And so, I mean, listen, you have to have a veteran coach in that situation. And, you know, it's not like Andy Reid had ever won a Super Bowl either. And that's what makes this such a remarkable five-star man performance for me, is that he was able to do all these things despite the reputation, despite the struggles that he had in Philly, you know, despite everything that had happened to him personally and professionally up to that point. A true five-star man performance by Andy. Let's turn to the trash man.
I'm the trash man. I come out, I throw trash all over the ring, and then I start eating garbage.
And these are the people who, through their play or their efforts in the game, are eating garbage all over the field. And yes, usually when we do these in the regular season, they tend to be Chiefs players. And sometimes, even in this playoff review that we're doing, they are Chiefs players. But tonight, they are not Chiefs players. My trash man is Kyle Shanahan. This bozo literally did not go for it on fourth down one single time before the last drive of the game and the last play of the game, right? Like, literally, you have to go for it on fourth and five because the game is over if you don't convert. He was not aggressive. He was 3 of 8 on third down, and I understand some of that is execution, but it's also on the offensive play caller. It's on the offensive play designer. And then, of course, he blew a 10-point lead late in a Super Bowl. Stop me if you've heard this one before or since.
Or we'll hear it again, yeah.
Or we'll hear it again if he makes it back there again. I mean, just like, how do you – I don't want to say that the Niners had this game won, but they certainly had a very good opportunity to win this game, and they squandered it because Kyle Shanahan is a trash man.
He is, and he was joined in his trashdom by his quarterback, Jimmy Garoppolo. Jimmy G just couldn't cut it. Through picking this game to Rashad Breeland, he overthrew the late play there to Manny Sanders. He rode a defense in a running game to a bunch of money, but he was just never the dude. He then proceeded to steal some money from the Raiders, which is a positive in my book, obviously. But
yeah, obviously.
He did not deserve to call himself a Super Bowl winning quarterback. And fortunately, he can't and never will be able to call himself that, because there's no chance that he will start for a Super Bowl winning team again. He just sucked in this game. He just wasn't a difference maker. You know, I see, to compare him to his successor at quarterback, Brock Purdy for San Francisco, I see so much of a difference between those two and how Brock Purdy plays. And, you know, yes, he's not the most physically overwhelming guy or anything like that, but like, I don't think that the comparison between Brock and Jimmy is very fair to Brock, because I think he's a better quarterback than Jimmy. But in this case, doesn't really matter either way. And Jimmy, you were a trash man.
He was a trash man. And so now we'll close it out with our wild cards. Why don't you do your wild card first? These are, of course, players who are capable of anything.
Wild card, bitches! Yeah!
And of course, you can't talk about a player more capable of anything than Patrick Mahomes. He's not often a wild card. Every now and then in our show, he kind of gets bumped down from five star to wild card. This one is a classic Pat wild card game, much like the 54-51 game, where, you know, he's a little turnover happy and not as effective as we're used to seeing him from start to finish, but, you know, made it matter when it mattered. Two picks and four sacks, but also the entire fourth quarter, completely put his team on the back, called for WASP, forged his legacy, did everything that we now look back and marvel at him. Patrick Mahomes, true wild card.
Mm-hmm. I will choose as my wild card the guy on the receiving end of the most iconic play in the Super Bowl, and that's Tyreek Hill. Tyreek had a really quiet game. He really had a quiet playoffs overall, and we've kind of been talking about him as a wild card really since we started this recap with Houston, and then through the Titans game where he scored a couple of touchdowns but didn't have the yardage. This was an up and down game for Tyreek, and they obviously, I mean, you mentioned the stat about the Niners zone defense, and this was their bread and butter. It was shutting down the big play. It was don't let Tyreek Hill beat you over the top. And it's funny in hindsight, you know, to go back and look at this game, because in a lot of ways, this is how teams have played defense against the Chiefs since this game, right? You know, it's
Yeah, good point.
a lot of too high shell, it's a lot of zone, it's a lot of, you know, flood the middle of the field and force him, you know, force him to go to check the ball down and
Yeah.
force him to become one dimensional and not beat you over the top. And yet on third and 15, you know, with the Super Bowl essentially on the line, which I don't think is an exaggeration, by the way,
I
because
agree.
if the Chiefs don't convert on that drive, surely if they got some yardage, you know, they go for it on fourth down. But you know, that was the play. I mean, it's going to be complete, or you're going to be going for it on fourth and 15.
Right,
Like
right.
that is pretty much the game.
Yep.
And with the Super Bowl on the line to come up with that play, which obviously hell of a play by Pat to get the ball off with pressure in his face, getting hit. But my God, I mean, there's no one else in the league that can run that play other than Tyreek Hill because of his unique speed and his unique, I don't know, just his ability to turn that speed into an unstoppable force on a football field. There's a lot of guys that have played football that are fast, but there is only one Tyreek Hill, and that's it. That's the ultimate wild card, and that is the Chiefs' victory in Super Bowl 54.
You remember him from his past work on Arrowhead Pride. You've seen him more recently on the network that is the undisputed home of the most widely respected coverage of Chiefs football in the kingdom, KCSN. You can usually find him in the lab with his guys, Maddie Lane and Kent Swanson. You've read his thoughts over the last 5 seasons in the KCSN draft guide, and you know that he is great. He is on Twitter at Craig under KCSN. Ladies and gentlemen, friend of the show, Craig
I was with you right up until the part where you said is great. Like everything
Stapp.
else was spot on. You said the is great, and you just completely lost me
You
on that
blacked
tenor. I'm
out.
sorry. I blacked out. Every time that happened, everybody doesn't realize that, but when that word is uttered now, I go into like a fugue state and like it's bad. Like it's really, really bad. You are so
Oh,
triggering at this point.
sorry to
Oh, that's
start you off
good.
on the wrong foot. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, guys. I happy to be
He is
back on
great. He is
here.
great. He is great.
No, he's not great.
He's doing
Fugue
great.
state. Lawyered, lawyered.
No, it's been really, really nice to get to do this with you guys every single year, usually around the draft here. And yeah, this is the right time to be talking with the both of you. And so I thank you very much for having me on your podcast again.
Craig, it's always a pleasure, and we are avowed Johnny come latelys to the draft. Obviously, we know it's important, and I love learning about these players when they become Chiefs players. I love everything about the draft, except I don't love it quite enough to watch college football and grind college football film. I just can't get into that, which is why we so appreciate you coming on and talking ball with us here about 3 weeks out from the draft. So before we get into some of the position groups that we're kind of curious about, just kind of give us the bird's eye view of this draft, as far as what positions are strong, what positions are weak, and what positions the Chiefs are going to be really locked in, focused on, with how you see the board maybe playing out.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to kind of start it, because I think everybody just kind of leaps into this is what the Chiefs need, and it, just an extreme focus on that sort of stuff. So this draft is, as it has been essentially for the last 5, 6 years, with the exclusion of maybe last year, an elite wide receiver draft. Yet again, the depth is really strong. The top end is insanely strong. We're going to get into wide receivers a little bit more as we got coming up here, but it's also really strong in the offensive line position as well. I've been very pleased, and the further and the deeper I get into offensive line, the more I'm like, man, I really like that guy. Where is he go? Oh, that's another day three guy. I feel comfortable with that as a nice depth piece for, you know, an offensive line like the Chiefs that's largely built. Cornerback is also a really strong position. It's more, you know, more top end focused. There's a little bit of a dip maybe in round two, but there's a lot of day three guys that I've just been pretty excited about that I think, oh man, I can really see how, you know, Brett Veach might be having a field day in day three yet again with some of these corners. So those are the three positions that as I get further into it, you know, I really am pleased with not just the top end, but the depth of the class as a whole. Happens to be three positions the Chiefs could draft, so that's very helpful as well. Good on Brett Veach for having, you know, kind of eyes on the future there. As far as positions that it's lacking, tight end is pretty gross this year. I know Brock Bowers is the kind of the big catch, you know, in round one there, and it falls off a cliff pretty quickly. There's a couple of day three guys that I'm okay with, but it's not the same kind of class that it was last year. I know that the Chiefs are very focused on Travis Kelce. Got to find that placement for Travis Kelce. You got to be able to, you know, insulate yourself because he's the only tight end on the roster after this year. So looking forward there, I don't love this tight end class in the same way that I loved last year's tight end class. And even the year before, that wasn't a great tight end class, not a very good tight end class. And it's an even worse linebacker and running back class. I'm not going to be surprised if a guy like Edgerrin Cooper, linebacker out of Mississippi, he's going to be end of round two. Like, that might be one of the first guys off the board from a linebacker perspective. Jonathan Brooks, running back out of Texas, also might be one of the first running backs off the board. That might be end of round two yet again. So those are two positions that you usually see teams like, especially in round two, you've got teams that are like, oh, okay, this is the prime time to take a linebacker. This is prime time to maybe finally select one of the top end running backs. I don't know that we're going to see that this year. So some of that typical stacking that drives guys down to the end of rounds that, you know, benefits the Chiefs, we're not really going to see that out of this class, especially from tight end, linebacker, and running back. It's just such a poor class in those three positions. It's one of those stay away scenarios. I like Jonathan Brooks. I wouldn't be mad at him. I'd be a little bit mad that they spent a pick on a running back, but, you know, I wouldn't be super mad about it, but he's one of the few guys that I think is deserving of that early of a pick. And frankly, with his injury history, round three is probably his real sweet spot. So keep an eye on those three positions. If they start going a little bit earlier, that's a big benefit for the Chiefs in a weak class.
Yeah. Fantastic overview. Love that, Craig. And like you said, let's just get into wide receivers because we like wide receivers. Everybody likes wide receivers. The wide receivers are good in this class. That's exciting. And, you know, the Chiefs kind of still need wide receivers. They obviously won the Super Bowl last year with Rashee Rice and a box of scraps at the position. But even after they added Hollywood Brown last month, that's obviously it's a one-year deal. The Rashee Rice legal situation is uncertain. This still feels very much like a position that they could target highly. But then you look at the Chiefs draft history and, you know, the highest this administration has gone on wide receivers round two, which they did with Hardman and then Rashee Rice. Mm-hmm. They have not taken a wide receiver in the first round since John Baldwin. I mean, that was all the way back in 2011. That was 13 years ago. So is this the year? What are the odds Chiefs are locking in a pick for a wide receiver at pick 32?
Higher than normal? I do think the odds are higher than normal. I'm not sure if it's pick 32, if that makes some sense.
Interesting. I know
that we've been having a lot of conversations about on the KC Lab about trading up, the pros and the cons of trading up just in general, not for specific players. Obviously, you know, we love specific players. Certain players are available. You trade up for those guys. You're cool with that. A Trent McDuffie scenario, for example. But I'm looking really hard at some of the top 30 visits that I'm seeing hit the board. Xavier Worthy, wide receiver out of Texas, small guy, ran the fastest 40 time in the history of the NFL combine. I know people have an idea in their head of what this player is right now, and he's not that. He's not John Ross. He's not a player like that. He's not fragile. He's got a full route tree that he can run. He's a player that I loved well before he blew up the combine. Knew he was going to be fast. Didn't know he was going to be that fast, but knew he was going to be fast. Now all of a sudden, teams like the Bills and the Colts are, you know, kind of interviewing him. Well, okay, so maybe he's going to be gone before, you know, the Chiefs have a reasonable trade-up range. Guy like Brian Thomas Jr. out of LSU, hearing rumors, I even heard it from, you know, somebody that I really trust with the NFL draft, saying if he makes it past 15, I'll be shocked. And so these were guys that, you know, yeah, absolutely. These were guys that a month ago I was looking at and going, oh boy, there you go. I feel good about that. Maybe a small trade up, maybe trade up to pick 24, 25, something like that. You feel comfortable with a small trade up to go get your guy. And now at this point, I'm looking at those two and going, that's probably too steep for this organization. I don't know that they want to mortgage their future for those guys in the same way that maybe we have, you know, talked about so far this process. So a round one wide receiver is absolutely on the board. I'm just not sure at pick 32 if they're going to love the options that are left. That's going to be probably like a Keon Coleman. We'll see if an A.D. Mitchell is there. I don't know if the Chiefs are going to love him coming out of the combine and saying, I ran all my routes 70%. That way I could go all game long. I know that rubbed a lot of NFL teams the wrong way. Sure. I'm not sure if the Chiefs are one of them, but based on some of their history, I can make an educated guess about that one, you know, whether or not they're going to like a guy like that. You know, then you're all of a sudden into maybe tier three of the wide receivers. Right. You're, you know, and now all of a sudden, I don't know if I love the 32 value. So, I think the odds are good. I think that they are going to play in this wide receiver class. I just am not sure if the juice is going to be worth the squeeze to trade up to get one of the top guys, or if they just want to sit there at 32 and say, you know what, we don't love the situation at wide receiver, we're going to go a different position here. So that's kind of where I am with wide receiver that early, especially since I like their options probably later in the draft as well.
I love that you brought up A.D. Mitchell, because that actually was going to be my next placement, my next question. The first guy I was going to ask about, I love looking at the KCSN draft guide, because you guys you're not afraid to be a little bit off of consensus. And I think that's important when you're doing evaluations, to really, you know, put stuff out there and not be afraid to just, you know, fall victim to groupthink. George Pickens, wide receiver one in the 2022 draft. That's like a pretty defensible ranking. I'm just saying, I understand why the Chiefs didn't take him. And you mentioned that as well. So after the consensus top three, Harrison Odunze, Neighbors, Brian Thomas, a wide receiver four, that's pretty in line with consensus. But you got A.D. Mitchell all the way down at nine, and that is a little bit lower. He seems to be consensus big board, kind of has him right around wide receiver five. And I'm kind of curious what it is about the player that you guys maybe were a little bit lower on. Is it the effort? Is it the fact that the production for a guy that tested as well as he did maybe wasn't there? Is it the stuff that you were hearing, you know, the combine, and obviously with your sources inside the league, or what was kind of driving that ranking?
Well, when we rank these guys, you know, we hear lots of things, a lot of them untrue, to be absolutely clear, just a lot of them completely untrue. And then some things, like last year, we hear, oh, there's some character concerns for Rashee Rice. And, you know, I know Maddie has talked about this on the lab, so I don't mind, you know, saying this, but he had heard some of the things. It was just like, oh, he's a little immature. You know, he's a little bit of a diva. He's a little bit of some of these things. And we kind of dismissed that as, no, you know, we only heard that from one source, not a big deal. Now all of a sudden we're in off season number one. We'll see what happens with that. So, you know, some things we hear that aren't true, some things we hear that are true. So we try and eliminate that. This is purely a film grade that we put on these players. We try not to factor in injuries. We try not to factor in character concerns, anything like that. That's why a George Pickens was number one, because guess what? His film was the best in that year, in our opinion. Now, obviously, character concerns can ruin everything, but if we tried to factor all that in, there's no real good way of judging that. A.D. Mitchell is not here because of his character concerns. Some of that effort does show up. I mean, like when I look over my notes for A.D. Mitchell, I say he's got elite body control. He is a super athlete, played at giant programs and big games, but there's no urgency to his routes. Just none. If he's not getting the ball, chances are good he's not even going to go through a full release. Like, he shuts it down, like, completely. And to the point where when you're watching tape, you're going, okay, so is he being coached to do this? Is this something that he's making a choice to do, or is this something that Texas is coaching him to do? So we went back to Georgia, and guess what? It's there too. Yeah. So it's not one of those. It's a choice that he's making there. So there are questions about, okay, is he running full speed through his breaks? Is he committing to it the same way? And when you watch it on tape and you're kind of going through and you're charting routes, you're like, okay, half of these routes are terrible. They're rounded off. There's no energy to him. He playing like he doesn't want the ball. And then the other half, when, you know, he's targeted or he's, you know, in that half of the field, if it's a half field read, he's one of the guys as part of the route distribution. He's trying really hard and it looks good. So it's one of those that we have to kind of factor. He's such a polarizing prospect because there is, you know, if you're just looking at the good, yeah, he's probably right up there. Right now we've got Ladd McConkey at number 5 on this, on our rankings. He's probably right up there with Ladd McConkey, but because there's that other half where you're looking at it and you're going, man, in the wrong situation, in the wrong spot, it's going to be bad. And I don't know if the Chiefs are the wrong spot. I don't know what the wide receiver position and the wide receiver coaching staff and the offensive coaching staff is going to fully look like. We haven't heard all of that shake out yet. Usually we get something that gets reported, but you know, we all kind of spent a long time last year complaining about how these wide receivers weren't developing outside of Rashee Rice, who was apparently glued to Travis Kelce's hip. But since we weren't seeing some of that development and some of that, you kind of also weigh some of those factors for the Chiefs where you think, I don't know if this is the right spot for him because of some of those other concerns.
So you mentioned Ladd McConkey, and you're doing great at this. I promise we did not give you any of the questions beforehand, and I promise that this is actually the next player on my list that I'm going to ask about. So you have him at West wide receiver 5. That is pretty in line with where most people have him going. What I find really interesting about that is obviously we've heard some concerns that, you know, maybe the wide receiver group will be a little picked over by the time the Chiefs get to their pick at 32. But for some reason, Ladd McConkey is a guy that seems to be connected to the Chiefs in essentially every mock draft that's coming out these days. The comp for him in the draft guide is a guy that the Chiefs were interested in, but were not allowed by the AFC establishment to trade for, Diontae Johnson. And so that's kind of an interesting comp to me. So I was wondering if you could just get into that a little bit, how you would see him fitting into the offense. Obviously, a guy with a little bit more polish that you wouldn't necessarily have to worry about the Chiefs wide receiver coaching ruining. Is that kind of the attraction there?
The floor is so high with Ladd McConkey. And I'm not just saying that because he's a white wide receiver, because that seems to be, you know, one of the general things that people say. No, yeah. He's such a smooth athlete. He, you know, everything is on time. You know, he's right at the top of his break when he needs to be. He is cutting when he needs to be. He is feeling the leverage of a cornerback or a safety or, you know, a linebacker in the middle of the field and readjusting his route on the fly without tipping it. Everything is so precise and smooth and accurate and on time. And when you think about the ways that Patrick Mahomes has operated, he operates with guys that get good separation and that are on time. Ladd McConkey and Diontae Johnson, to, you know, that same sort of extent, do both of those things exceptionally well. They're not just zone beaters. They are man beaters. It is tough to defend a Ladd McConkey or a Diontae Johnson coming out of their stem. 5 yards out, you don't know if this is going to be a go route, this is going to be a hitch, this is going to be an in-breaker, out-breaker. There's no real sell to it. And then on top of that, there's enough nuance where he can sell a fake route at the top of it without losing the timing of it. So a guy that makes a lot of sense in this offense from the standpoint of, you just need a dude that's going to beat man coverage, that's going to create separation immediately, that's going to be exactly where Patrick wants him, exactly when he wants him there. It makes all the sense in the world from that standpoint until you realize that he is a guy that operates almost exclusively out of the slot. Not going to be a guy that beats press. He's not a big guy. He's not necessarily one of those, you know, he's quick out of his breaks, does not necessarily have long speed. So you're not going to put him on the outside and say, go win outside the numbers. That's not who he is. And with the type of offense that the Chiefs play, where they've got Hollywood Brown that is going to operate a little bit out of the slot and as a Z wide receiver, Rashee Rice, who's going to operate both outside and out of the slot. So kind of a 50-50 sort of deal. You almost want a guy that is more of a true X, is a guy that can play on the outside, a line on the line of scrimmage. So there's a lot of sameness with Ladd McConkey in the current Chiefs wide receiving core. I still think he's a high fit. Don't get me wrong. Like, sure. I think he's a terrific player, would fit in Kansas City, but it's why the fit is kind of murky. You know, it's why if he was on the board and the Chiefs passed on him, I'd be like, okay, I get it. There's only so many slot targets that are there to go around, and this is a guy that's not going to play a ton on the outside. So you're probably not going to be playing a guy like that at the same time as Hollywood Brown and Rashee Rice. Like, those three don't make a ton of sense together, but I'd be willing to find it out because he does everything that Patrick wants him to do when he wants him to do it.
Yeah, one of those guys that's probably, you can tell, is going to be a good pro. Just not sure if he's going to be a good pro on your team or not.
Yes.
So let's say the Chiefs have a guy that drops that means that they go away from wide receiver in round one. Now we're sitting here in day two. And we know that regardless if it's going to be round one or round two, they're almost definitely taking a wide receiver somewhere early. Who are some guys that might slot into more of the day two type that you either think A, the Chiefs really like, or B, you would like the Chiefs to like?
I mean, I think guy that the Chiefs might like, Jermaine Burton out of Alabama, flown a little bit under the radar here, a really smooth mover. Chiefs run a ton of curl routes, hitches, you know, basically that short outside route from their X wide receiver. I went through and I kind of had some charting data that I was able to lean on for their wide receivers in the past. One of the most run routes is a curl route, you know, kind of stemming from out routes and go routes. It's a natural progression to try and keep the cornerback on their toes. Jermaine Burton's got that ability to just run a really crisp, snapped curl route that a corner doesn't see coming. So it's really, really good. But what I really love is how he keeps working on scramble drills. Like a guy,
I love that.
When we think of Patrick Mahomes, right? Yeah. Absolutely. When we think of Patrick, we think late in the rep, guys aren't open right now. He's going to create and he's going to get, you know, afford people the opportunity to get open 4 seconds into that. Jermaine Burton's probably the best receiver in this class at scramble drills. That's even beating some of these top guys. He just has such a natural feel of rolling with the play, getting to where he needs to go. So he makes a ton of sense. He also finds and sits in space well against zone coverage, with the Chiefs are probably going to see a lot more with a guy like Hollywood Brown that could take the top off of it. And he's got enough vertical speed to test and force too high coverages there. So there's a lot of that. His big knock is that he's not really a yak guy. Chiefs love yak guys, so we'll see how they fit there. And he's got off-field concerns. Now, in most drafts, I would say, hey, perfect Chiefs fit there, you know,
right.
Off-field concerns. But another guy that, coming off of the Rashee Rice stuff, I don't know if he's on the Chiefs board in the same way. I love his game and how he would fit in this offense, but I don't know if he's a guy that they will take a chance on it. So maybe a little bit later, a Javon Baker out of UCF, wide receiver, really physical, willing blocker, especially downfield. Like, it's a guy, he lives to go seek out a safety in the run game and dig him out and put him on his ass. Like, guys like that we think about, that's an MVS type thing. Like, yeah. I know that people wanted to run MVS down, but that's what he lived for, is getting up to the third level and doing that. You're going like for like with a guy like Javon Baker. Got good mixed up releases. His route tempo variance is just A+, and a go up and get it attitude. He just doesn't have any speed. So you're going to be playing him in the shallow and intermediate areas of the field. It's where Patrick Mahomes can really work there. But, you know, he needs to kind of develop a little bit more coming out of his breaks. That's probably why he's going to be a round three guy, maybe an early round three guy. So the Chiefs would have to select him at 64. I love him. I love his effort. He seems like a guy that Andy Reid would love, just because he's going to show up and do everything right. He's the Mike Dana of wide receivers in this class. That's what it kind of reminds me. Just show up, do everything technically, do all the grunt work, know that you're not going to win with athleticism in the same way. Those are two guys that I'd be looking at for 64. So, you know, There's some Tez Walker, you know, vertical speed that I could see them potentially being interested in. A Jalen McMillan or a Jalen Polk out of Washington. Both of those guys came out of an air raid offense. Those are going to be guys around 64 as well. I just don't know that they move the needle in the same way for me. I like them all, but they don't move the needle in the same way that a Javon Baker or Jermaine Burton does for me.
You know what moves the needle for Jermaine Burton for me is Amari Cooper, Julio Jones, Calvin Ridley, Jalen Waddle, Devontae Smith, Jerry Jeudy, a.k.a. yeah, I mean, Alabama wide receivers in the NFL.
There's a few of those.
They just have done such a good job over the years of and obviously when you're recruiting the best people in the country, that's going to happen, but naturally. But I just, every time Alabama receivers come out, I always feel like they're so polished and they're so NFL ready because of obviously the high bar that was placed there. So as soon as you mentioned Jermaine Burton, I was like, yeah, I mean, if the Chiefs picked up an Alabama wide receiver, I certainly would not be too disappointed in that.
And to be fair, he only played 2 years at Bama, his final 2 years, only 2 years. And you look at the stats, his last year, 39 catches for 798 yards and 8 touchdowns. So it's not like the same sort of volume targets that some of those other guys got, but he started at Georgia for 2 years as well. It's not like he was coming out of relative obscurity here. Yeah. He's gotten excellent coaching coming into the league so far.
Playing in Alabama and Georgia, not a bad way to spend your college career. I want to ask you about a guy that did not have a college career. And in fact, this is more wide receiver draft adjacent question. This is about the newest Chiefs project player, rugby superstar Lewis Rees-Zammit. I'm just curious, if he were part of this class instead of being an international pathway program, would he have been worthy of a look in the later rounds? Would he have been more of a UDFA type? Like, how would you have kind of lined him up with this class?
He would have been a tough eval in this class. Let's say he went somewhere and played in college for a year, depending on where it was that he went, you're going to be talking about a guy that we would probably view as more of a gadget player, probably classify him as a running back, but played in the slot a little bit, kick returner, obviously, that's where the Chiefs view him there, would probably be a later day three guy. The vision's not going to be there. I know that he's got rugby vision, which is going to be great for kickoffs, but running between the tackles when things are a lot more condensed is going to be, I mean, I'm excited for the kid and all that, but I know a lot of people are like, yeah, we're going to line him up in the backfield. Chiefs going to line him up in the backfield all the time. It's going to be great. I'm so excited for him. Like, well, let's pump the brakes on that.
Big learning curve there.
There's a huge learning curve reading out a zone blocking scheme, which the Chiefs are going to do there, but I can see them designing ways to get him the ball and try and get him as a one cut and go runner, a guy that you don't have to rely on a ton of elusiveness. He's got the physicality to run through guys. He would be a guy that we might put in the draft guide as like a late day three flyer, you know, making our list here, but not a guy that we're probably talking a ton about, but would be one like if the Chiefs drafted him, we would immediately know, much like when, you know, he was, you know, signed by the Chiefs earlier this offseason, we immediately knew it was like, oh, that's for kick returns. Yep. Like we know exactly what that's for. I'm excited for him on kick returns. And I think that's his clearest path to the roster right now. And to be clear, if he just hangs out on the practice squad this year as an international pathway player, it's a worthy investment. Like take stabs at stuff like that. Chu Godrick last year was the best investment that didn't get to play football. Like it really was. It was amazing. So I'm excited for him, but I think, I think you're kind of aligned with me there. It would be a late day three guy that we would see.
Craig, let's turn to the cornerbacks. Obviously the Chiefs made a move a couple weeks ago, sending Legarius Sneed out after a sterling season and obviously Super Bowl winning season for the Chiefs to the Titans. The Chiefs could, obviously, in the first round, draft, you know, a one-for-one replacement for Legarius Sneed. If they were to do that, and understanding what kind of player Legarius Sneed was for the Chiefs, playing a different kind of cornerback, a different style of cornerback than a guy like Trent McDuffie, who would that guy be in this draft?
Man, that is really tough early on. I mean, the guy that I love and is a tier one CBAT, which is my little BS thing that I do.
We'll get into it.
KCSN draft guide. We'll get into it. But, you know, the guy that I love, Quinyon Mitchell out of Toledo. I started hearing his name a lot towards the end of last year as a guy that's like, hey, keep an eye on this Toledo kid. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. And then he started just exceptionally well this season and is worthy of a round one pick. I'm going to be shocked if he makes it past about pick 17, 18. Like, I don't think that the Chiefs realistically have a shot at getting him. I think he's going to be one of, if not the top corner. It's either him or Terrion Arnold out of Alabama that I think go high. As far as guys that are going to be available towards the end of the round for the Chiefs, Nate Wiggins out of Clemson is probably, you know, a really good fit for what the Chiefs like to do, as well as a guy like Kool-Aid McKinstry. I'm lower on than probably everybody else in the KCSN draft guide. I know he's playing a little bit hurt this past year. That
it's the name, man.
Contributes to him.
It's the name. Everybody's into it.
Everybody's into it. Like, it was one of those that even when he wasn't having his best season, and maybe this is just my own personal, you know, bias, which is why we have so many people that watch these things. It's not just my take that is equating to the grade here. But while he wasn't playing particularly well, and I'm watching other defensive backs on that Bama roster that are playing better than him, and he's getting this top five buzz midway through the collegiate season, I'm going, I don't know what you guys are watching right now. So, you know, it might be just a kind of natural gut reaction to some of that. I think that's kind of leveled out again. He's probably worthy of a round one pick, a late one for sure. I could see the Chiefs looking at him and going, hey, he's a true boundary corner. He's a really, you know, heralded recruit. We feel comfortable coming out of that program that we are going to get a player that's going to walk right in. And now all of a sudden, we don't feel like we have to start both Joshua Williams and Jalen Watson. They certainly could. And I believe that they're probably going to try to do that. But I could see them seeing that the value is there for a Nate Wiggins or a Kool-Aid McKinstry if they're still available at 32, certainly on the board. I wouldn't say that it's one of those things that, oh, they're definitely not going to go corner early. Certainly on the board to have a defensive player their first one taken.
I'm curious what you think about the odds of the Chiefs going with the DB with their first pick, whether it be at 32 or a little earlier or a little later, because obviously two seasons ago, Brett Veach trades up for Trent McDuffie, blue chip player. But other than that, Brett Veach is like, screw it. Give me day three defensive backs. We will turn them into all pros, and then we will let them walk in free agency, or we'll trade them on the franchise tag like they just did with Legarius Sneed. And it's pretty hard to argue with the results. I mean, it's if there's been a better team at drafting, you know, starting defensive backs on day three of the draft than the Chiefs, I don't know what it is. So will they break with, I mean, are we going to see another Trent McDuffie style pick? Like, what are the odds that they're looking at a DB for their first pick in this draft?
I will say they're pretty low. Like, I just think that I think if this corner class was a lot weaker than it is, especially on day three with Brett Veach just, you know, lives his best life over there, I would say that it's pretty low. There's a couple of guys that I could see that maybe their skill set makes sense for what Steve Spagnuolo wants to do. Cooper DeJean out of Iowa is just this exceptional player that has played corner at Iowa for a long time and, you know, also maybe play some safety in the NFL. He's a super athlete as well and has just played football at such a high level. Great returner. I can see the Chiefs just saying, this checks four boxes for us within Steve Spagnuolo's defense.
Well, white corner.
Not to mention what? White corner.
Yes, I mean, that's, I know, like, that's the white whale of the NFL. Like,
it is the white whale of the NFL. It is incredibly rare, and he is such an athletic marvel that, you know, you can line him up at safety, you can line him up at corner, you can play him at punt returner, kick returner. It makes so much sense in so many different levels. I could see them gambling on a guy like that because it checks so many boxes, but I think that they're going to lean offense early. I do think that they're going to lean offense early. And Brett Veach is just going to say, hey, listen, I'm going to keep rolling the dice on these day three guys. We are really good at finding these day three guys, especially in round four. We are exceptional at finding guys that are going to contribute to our defense that Steve Spagnuolo and Dave Merritt get the most out of. Why would we spend a super high draft pick on a guy when we've got one of the best defensive back coaches in the league and one of the best defensive coordinators in the league that maximize these guys? Let's take advantage of that market, you know, inefficiency that we essentially have at the coaching staff. Now, I know the Trent McDuffie argument there. Chiefs did not expect Trent McDuffie to be there. They had such a high grade, like an obscenely high grade on Trent McDuffie, and it got to the point where they went, well, we just can't pass on this guy. You want to tell me that Quinyon Mitchell ends up at pick 23 and isn't picked and the Chiefs trade up for it? I get it, because it's an insanely high grade on a guy and you just can't pass on another blue chip like that. I just think it's going to take that level of a fall from an elite player to really make them take a defensive back early.
Well, hopefully Buffalo's around to give the Chiefs another nice little trade-up slot there. That would be nice.
Hey, listen, whoever they select, whatever DB they select after the Chiefs, if they trade up for Quinyon Mitchell, the one that the Bills take right after that is not going to play.
That's and, right. You know, that's right.
It's just history.
That's just how it works. When we were prepping for this, Austin called it the Day 3 Brett Veach DB Blue Light Special. Do you have anybody kind of – I know it's harder to predict those guys, but like a seventh rounder where you're like, oh, this guy's it.
Yeah. Looking back, I am always going to lean on athletic testing for a part of this because of CBAT and because like it's shown its worth over 14 years now, and it's been incredibly predictive. Ryan Watts out of Texas that some people are projecting to play as a safety. We got to see him play at the Shrine game. He played safety there, but he played corner at Texas. He's got this hybrid flexibility and he is a tier one CBAT guy. You know, he weighs 208 pounds, ran a 4.5 340, which is not, you know, super fast, crazy explosive, 40 and a half inch vertical and a 6.823 cone. That is really silky smooth. So that is one of those guys that you look at and you say, oh, he's good in run support. He's a physical dude. That's a huge dude. He's going to be a good blitzer. Boy, it sounds like, and he's a super athlete and on top of everything. Boy, that sounds like guys that the Chiefs have taken in round four lately, like, and really maximized. So I've got my eye on Ryan Watts just because of his testing. The tape's not phenomenal, but the tape for some of these other guys that they've taken in round four is not phenomenal.
Sure.
Is what has happened. So, you know, gamble on athletic traits there. Outside of guys like that, there are a number of players that I you know, we got to watch in person at the Shrine game that I really like. You know, there's what's his name out of Florida State? I'm blanking on it right now. Jerrion Jones out of Florida State might be more of a slot guy, a little bit of an overlap for Trent McDuffie, but also another terrific athlete. I love his swagger. I love his ability to kind of be dialed in and feel really strongly about things. When we interviewed him, he was our most entertaining interview. You know, he was FaceTiming with his girlfriend at the time and walked up and just kind of put the phone in his lap.
Sick.
And she just chilled the entire time. We did a 20-minute interview and he was really engaging, really extremely confident in his abilities, and it showed on the field. And it shows when you watch some of these games. Florida State played LSU very, very early in the year. Renardo Green is one of the corners that is probably going to go day two from Florida State. He got to match up against, you know, Malik Nabers and really did a good job of shutting him down. Same with Brian Thomas Jr. But every time one of those guys kicked into the slot, Jerry Jones locked him up too.
Sick.
So flying a little bit under the radar from that perspective. Looking at some other guys, like there's some other CBAT guys that we can talk about here in a little bit.
Let me catch the readers up on CBAT just to kind of get everybody on the same page. This is one of your major contributions to the KCSN draft guide. It's always so interesting. I'm going to quote from the draft guide from you, so do not sue me for intellectual property. This is this is just to catch the reader or the listeners up. So you said, you know, this is cornerback athletic testing. You said you look back at every cornerback that had participated in the combine or was drafted since 2010. And developed a weighted formula to attempt to predict success tailored around athletic testing, regardless of draft position. So the formula used You have five criteria that it mainly uses, applying some of the relevant data to what cornerbacks do on the field: length, size, arm length, 40 time, vertical jump, broad jump, three cone, and bench press. So those are your CBAC qualifiers. And then you had a cool list of some guys that are in your tier one athletic testing. And so that would be, you mentioned Ryan Watts out of Texas. That's also Max Melton from Rutgers, Miles Battle from Utah, Quinyon Mitchell, Toledo, exactly. DeCamrion Richardson from Mississippi State, and Elijah Jones from Boston College. So that's kind of, when you're saying your tier one CBAC grades, those are athletic freaks first and foremost. Those are guys that are, for what a cornerback has to physically do on the field, these guys check all your boxes there. Really, really like that breakdown, like the way that you approach that. I always have. I feel like athleticism is the thing that, you know, you can't really, you can get guys better, but you can't really teach for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so you bring the freak athletes in, you can teach them how to play football, but you got to make sure they can run faster and jump higher than anybody else on the other team. So I've just always, I've really liked that approach by you.
Well, and it's not just that. And yes, that was my original line of thinking. It was just like, hey, what's a way to kind of identify some of these guys, not just in round one, you know, obviously looking at here, it, you know, I kind of sort this out by contribution. So basically, you know, it's like 60% of the snaps in any given year, if you've been the primary choice starter before injury, you know, things like that, where it's just like the team was planning on you being an integral part of this, or you were an integral part of this. You are a contributor to this defense. You were worthy of that roster spot. You weren't just kind of living on special teams, specifically defense. Round one players, 95% of the corners in round one, or sorry, 83% of the corners in round one. I was just looking at the tier one guys. 83% of the corners in round one are contributors. Round two drops to about 66, and then it just plummets after that. Guys just don't contribute in a meaningful way there, which makes it even more special what the Chiefs are doing in day three, because there's not contributing factors that are there. It's not just that either. It's also one of the things that we can look at here and say, okay, all pro, Pro Bowl, you know, okay, sure. You know, Pro Bowl is a little bit of a popularity contest here, but if you are a tier one guy, 20% of those guys that are tier one make a Pro Bowl at some point in their rookie contract. Not overall.
So hard to do.
Correct. In their rookie contract, 20% of them make it. The highest, tier two, I split it in four tiers. Tier two, 6% make it. Mm-hmm. So 20%, over three times as likely. All pro, which is much more difficult to do in your rookie contract, 10% of the tier one guys make an all pro. These are guys that, you know, it doesn't matter. Round does not matter in this scenario. Obviously, guys that are drafted a little bit earlier, round one guys, 3% of them in round one, you know, kind of make that. But that's overall, again, 10%. So it's very difficult to miss on a tier one guy. About 75% of them become contributors in their rookie contract. So I just am completely fine with the Chiefs routinely taking bites at the apple from this. Legarius Sneed was a tier one guy. Guess what? That really worked out. Yes. Nazee Johnson is a tier one guy. We'll see if that works out. I know the Chiefs had high hopes for him last year. We will see. He's still on his rookie contract. He can still become a contributor. Not yet.
He was trending really highly before his injury. Was. I mean, it absolutely was very exciting.
It was a legitimate, he is keeping Joshua Williams and Jalen Watson at bay. That was not camp talk. Right. That was legitimate. So we'll see. Maybe, you know, we're doing all this talk about cornerbacks and everything like that. Maybe they're sitting there looking at Nazee Johnson and going, that's our guy. We know we already have him on the roster. We're comfortable with our roster. But a guy like Miles Battle out of Utah, who might be a UDFA, the tape is not good. He played at Ole Miss for 4 years, started in the SEC for his final 2 years there, then went to Utah and started for a year. He's a guy that nobody's talking about. He's a tier one tester. You know, he's 6'3", 196 with freakishly long arms, runs a 4.37 40 with a 37-inch vertical and a 6.8 4.3 cone. Nobody's talking about him because the tape's not great. You think that, you know, Brett Veach and company are looking at that and going,
no,
if he makes it to UDFA, I'm cool with it. Or round
Yeah,
seven. Let's
Dave
take
Merritt
the
will fix him
gamble.
right up.
Absolutely the case. So I have kind of pivoted my looking at corners and my watching at corners, my projecting at corners of the Chiefs almost fully to who's in day three that's got these good athletic traits. Doesn't have to be tier one. Shamari Connor wasn't a tier one guy. He was high tier two, but he wasn't a tier one guy. But these high athletic trait guys later in the draft, because you just have so much confidence in Dave Merritt and Steve Spagnuolo. Why not start with the high athletic ceiling and then just kind of work your way into the rest of it?
Okay, Craig. So wide receivers, cornerbacks, very sexy, very cool. But are the Chiefs just going to draft a tackle? Is
Yeah,
that what's going to happen?
probably.
Yeah. Who's going to be if they take a tackle at 32?
I mean, I think if they're going to take a tackle at 32, it's really like the board is just going to be a complete mess. I have
Sure.
talked to so many different people at this point, not just from, a Chiefs perspective, but, league wide. I'm lucky enough to know a few people here and there. And so, as I talk to them, nobody's got a good bead on where the tackles are slotting. Even at the top, like
Interesting.
it seems very easy for me to be like, oh, hey, Joe Alt should go number one. Olufashanu should go number two. Like, as far as the rankings of that, that's not necessarily what I've heard from,
Interesting.
the wider thing. And this started even at the combine. So it's not just one of those late things that were here and there. Realistically, guys that will pro that could be available to the Chiefs near the end of the draft, a JC Latham from Alabama, more of I think he's kind of being projected a little bit as a right tackle prospect. I don't know if he could really, kind of fit in there. It's sim He's got a similar sort of traits, and the way that he plays is very similar to Orlando Brown Jr., so they're obviously comfortable with that. I just don't know if that's the preferred method. Tyler Guyton out of Oklahoma makes a lot of sense because he's a super athlete. He's going to get way deep into his drop. We know that they really liked a few of those types of guys. Andy Heck prefers those types of guys, but I don't know if he's ready to step in day one and play. He'd be a good guy to come in there and really push, Wanya Morris a little bit there.
Sure.
And but I don't know that it's going to be one of those where you really feel comfortable with, oh, Tyler Guyton's definitely your left tackle of the future, especially since he moved to right tackle. Another guy there, Kingsley. I'm not going to try and pronounce his last name. Suamatia, I believe. Forgive me if I just absolutely slaughtered that. Out of BYU, checks so many boxes for Andy Reid, like athletic. Explosive,
Went to
good
BYU.
length, went to
Went to BYU.
BYU. Yeah, I
Huge
mean, like,
plus.
huge plus. So he's also a ridiculously young player, so that checks a box for, for Brett Veach as well. Like, he just turned 21, in January. So
Jeez, really
he's
young.
very, very young. So you've got a long window for him. Those are kind of the guys towards the end of round one that I could see. Maybe if the Chiefs wanted to trade back a little bit, go with a Patrick Paul out of Houston. I believe he's got 36-inch arms. He's got absolute vines. So would be a good fit. Good athlete as well, really big waist bender. There's a lot that you have to correct there, but you feel good about the physical traits of that. We just got done talking about that for corner. I subscribe to that for offensive tackle as well. And the Chiefs, largely outside of Orlando Brown Jr., do as well when they're trying to get guys long term. But I look at this a little bit and I say, if there is so much uncertainty at the top of the draft about who's going to be there and when, is there an opportunity here where the Chiefs feel comfortable waiting and trading up for a guy like, let's call him Amarius Mims out of Georgia, who has played next to no snaps in college? Also 21 years old, will be 21 when the season starts as well. He is 6'7", has freakish movement ability, like just eye-popping tight end level movement ability and length and all of this. He's just never played. And so I could see him just falling completely down draft boards because He barely played his junior year. He barely played 2 years ago. He barely played last year. Just got hurt a lot. But when the tape, when you turn on the tape and you look at it, it's so good that he's gonna go early. It doesn't matter, you know, the number of reps. I can see the Chiefs saying, "That's our guy. We're gonna take a gamble on an athletic guy. Let's go get the most athletic guy that we can in this class and feel comfortable with him moving forward." So I could see them making a small move up for an offensive tackle with all the uncertainty there. It just feels like a guy's going to shake out towards the end of the round. I am ecstatic with an offensive tackle, to be clear here. It's not the sexiest pick in the world. I'd love to have a Brian Thomas Jr., Xavier Worthy, whatever the case. I might be more excited about an Amarius Mims because I can see how that fits into the offense and makes this team so much better for so long.
Yeah, I mean, the Chiefs have had a lot of luck at several positions, just taking the most athletic guy and trusting the three-time Super Bowl champion coaching staff to coach those guys up. Last question for me, one more from Taylor. I think I ask you this each of the last 2 years, but it's pick 32, Chiefs are on the clock. Who is the guy that you're going to be most excited to hear his name called, and who is the pick that is going to have you downing that glass of sweet, sweet holiday distillery bourbon to drown out the pain of whoever gets picked.
I love that you shouted out the fact that we are going to be at Holiday Distillery for the entire draft.
You
That's
know, I listen to the
wonderful.
pod, Craig. Big fan.
I
Love the work.
appreciate that. I appreciate that.
First
Hey,
time, long time.
anybody in the Kansas City area, come to the party on Sunday. Go to the KCSN socials and RSVP for that. It's going to be a good time. There's going to be lots of drinks flowing, lots of food and drinks on KCSN. So it's a good time. We'll be there. We'll be hanging out. Don't let that detract you from coming. The rest of it is great. So now I'm ecstatic. Let's just go ahead and say I said his name already. I'm ecstatic about Amarius Mims. I think the long-term future of that young player with the sky's the limit. All he's got to do is stay healthy. And we're not talking about him as a guy that might be available near the end of the draft. We're talking about a guy that's a surefire top 10 prospect in an excellent offensive tackle class. You are talking about him in the same breath as a Joe Alt, as an Olu Fashanu, as a Troy Fontenot, as a Talise Fuaga, all of those guys that have been thrown around as those early, potentially top 15 picks. Amarius Mims might be the top of the heap if he gets to play an entire season. So I'm ecstatic about that, fully knowing that the other thing that's coming out of my mouth immediately when that happens is he's barely played football. You know, that's a big deal, and I understand it, and that's why he would be available. A pick that would have me kind of downing my drink at the end of the draft. Oh my goodness. I think if the Chiefs, ooh. Man, okay. I'm going to say something that might not be a super popular thing here. If the Chiefs, I'll give you two things that'll make me drown my drink. So the first one is Chiefs trade way up, way, way, way up. I'm saying pick 13, 14, 15. Yeah, massive trade up. And they pick Brock Bowers.
Oh,
Okay.
yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that's
I'm
interesting.
going to
That
be a
would
little
be
bit. Like,
nifty.
I get exactly how he fits. The offense just got way better. Like, I love Brock Bowers. He's the best tight end in this class. He would be an exceptional fit in Kansas City. I hate trading up that and giving up that much for a tight end. Like, I just, it, th there's only so much that he's going to do. Oh, you can play him in the slot. Cool. Take Xavier Worthy and play him in the slot. At that point, you know, there are so many other guys that I think just fit so much better, offer so much more. I love Brock Bowers. I know that Andy Reid would just absolutely feast with him and Travis Kelce and Noah Gray on the field together. We'd see lots of 13 personnel. It wouldn't matter if it's heavy boxes. He'd be able to get open, and throwing out a 13 personnel would be one of the most dangerous things in the league right now for teams that are going so light. Like, again, I'm saying all this. I know exactly how he fits and exactly what he does for this offense. Giving up that kind of capital would just not sit great with me for a tight end specifically. Going to pick 32 there. Now all of a sudden we're getting into, oh, let's call it, no, let's call it a Keon Coleman, a realistic okay. one, a Keon yeah. Coleman. I don't dislike Keon Coleman. I think I can see the path for it, especially I just got done talking about how he is an ex wide receiver. He's going to align on the line of scrimmage. He's going to be able to win a little bit down the field. You're going to be able to put the ball in his hand too, and he's going to be able to run through some players. So there are lots of things that he does that fit with what the Chiefs do, but he can't separate, and he has really, really exceptionally bad drops. The separation comes from the fact that he's not a particularly good route runner right now. He needs a lot of development in that realm. And the hands part of that is just a complete focus level thing. You see him get way too deep on some things. The technician part of that just isn't there. Yes, he's a great athlete. And I get the reason why people would want him there. I know that his 40 time was not exceptional, but everything else was terrific. And when you watched him run some of the drills that he ran, it looks pretty decent there. But he's a young guy. He's still got room to grow. I just don't want to take a gamble on a wide receiver that's going to require the level of development to be able to get him on the field with so many different
The track record there hasn't been great.
It's not great. Nope. It's not great. I know that you would hope that he develops into the next Rashee Rice, that sure. he is able to take that next step. But in reality here, counting on a wide receiver to take significant development in the NFL draft, coming out of the NFL draft for the Kansas City Chiefs, is something that we need a lot more data on before we can right. start to expect it. So,
and also, there are some position groups where you could afford project players, and the Chiefs can't afford one right now at wide receiver. Like, they need correct. To hit the ground running with that pick just because of the position that the roster's in, the pressure on them to go out. You know, if they were a bottom-tier team, then it's kind of mm-hmm. like, all right, sure, that's that, you know, but the Chiefs are going to be, everyone's going to be gunning for the back-to-back champs, so they can't be taking a project at 32. My last question for you is kind of just more the local focus of the three main colleges around here, KU, K-State, Missouri. Do you have anybody between, whether it's Cooper Beebe, Dominic Pooney, Darius Robinson, and Ennis Rakestraw? Those are kind of the guys that are towards the top of the board from all three schools. Anybody's striking your eye that you're curious to either see where they go or how they fit, or maybe someone that might go higher than people are expecting in the draft?
I mean, Ben Sinnott. I think
tight end from K-State.
I think he's probably going to be more of an H-back at the next level or fullback or something like that. But he's got the movability. Juszczyk light. How about sure. I throw that?
That's
out
a great there, compliment you know? To Sinnott, because Juszczyk's obviously it, amazing.
Yeah, I mean that in the best possible way for him. I know the Chiefs hosted him. Wasn't sure if it was a top 30, if it was just a local pro day. Either way, the Chiefs uh-huh. had him in-house. I'm very interested to see where he ends up going. I can see, you know, there are a lot of teams that drafting Sinnott, I would immediately jump out and just be like, oh man, that is a perfect fit. I see exactly how a team is going to use him. And then I see some other teams that might be like, oh, we're just going to use him as an inline blocker all the time. We're going to do this. I just don't think that fits his skill set or maximizes it. He's going to be able to do that. I don't mean to slight him in that way, but it's not going to be the same level of usage that we've seen. If he goes to a Shanahan tree offense, I'm excited about what he could do. That would
yeah,
be like late
Miami
round
or somewhere. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Fantasy football TE2 sort of thing that I'm starting to get a little excited about. Dominic Pooney, I really like him. As an interior guy, probably for the Chiefs at this point. He's really versatile. Athleticism, you know, plenty of experience at multiple positions. So he's going to be able to do a lot of the things that the Chiefs ask their interior offensive lineman to do and just kind of kick around to do all of that. And it's a guy that you could probably take. I don't know where he's going to go. It might be a round two guy. He could go as high as that, but more likely maybe a round three guy. If he's there at the end of round three, I'm excited about a pick like that. Yeah, he's a little older prospect, but
sure.
You're not expecting anything this year out of him. And now you've got insurance for Trey Smith and or Joe Tooney later. Like, I'm excited about a pick like that. And then for the Missouri Tigers, Javon Foster, offensive tackle, another guy that was in-house for the Chiefs this past week. It, again, maybe was a local pro day thing. may have been more of a top 30 visit, but just has the mentality of an Andy Heck offensive tackle. Really tough, has a lot of roles that he has played really well. Gives you a lot of depth there, you know. And I think if you are trying to do a little bit of not exactly left tackle by committee, but you're trying to give somebody to push Wanya Morris, I think Javon Foster is going to come in with that right mentality of this is my job, I want it. And he's got the length, obviously. So you could see him use that really well. The
Six
Chiefs have
five, he's a big boy.
6'5". Yeah. He is a very big, long offensive tackle as well. So another guy that, you know, if he's around and round four or round five or something like that, he slips down that far and the Chiefs take him. Again, I'm excited about that pick because I'm excited about the depth that they've added at offensive tackle. I think Javon Foster is going to play in this league. I think his floor is a really quality swing tackle in this league. And because this class is so strong, he's not going to be drafted maybe as high as he would in some other classes. It's good for the Chiefs, and it would be fun, you know, to have another local guy that you could really kind of hang your hat on if you're a Mizzou fan.
Well, Craig, thanks so much for the contributions. You obviously make our show much more informed. We really appreciate your time. Tell the people where they can find the KCSN draft guide and go pick this thing up before the draft and learn all these cool facts about all these players.
Absolutely. You can go to gum.co/KCSN24. If you do that, the draft guide is $13.99. And when you do that, you get a 3-month free subscription to the KCSN Substack. KCSN Substack is where myself, Kent Swanson, Maddie Lane, Joseph Hefner, and Tyler Brown, we all write articles on there. You'll have something brand new in your inbox every single day. That's where we do film breakdowns, big analytic breakdowns. Done a lot of stuff lately. A lot of people were kind of clued in on the fact that maybe the Chiefs weren't getting as high of a pick for Legarius Sneed as they wanted to, because I did a very deep dive into historical cornerback trades since the new, you know, CBA was signed in 2011. So we're doing a lot of that stuff on the website. It also gets you access to the KCSN Discord channel, which I know you guys have a Discord channel as well. Be in both. It's really fun to kind of participate and hang out with other Chiefs fans when you're not on, you know, maybe not dealing with the dreck of the universe on some other platforms. It's really fun to be in some of those other spots.
Well said. Well, we appreciate it, buddy. We'll talk to you next time.
All right, thanks.
That's going to do it for this week's episode of It's Always Sunny in Chiefs Kingdom. Join us next week. See you guys next time.